Hello, and welcome to our program. My name is Robert Mayberry, and I will be reading The Economist, the week of April 13th through 19th, 2024, here on Sight and Sound Radio. The World This Week, The Economist. This week's covers, how we saw the world. We have two covers this week. In most of the world, we warn that global warming is coming for your home and ask, who will pay for the damage? In Britain, we look at the case for assisted dying, which has a chance of soon becoming law. About a tenth of the world's residential property by value is under threat from global warming, including many houses that are nowhere near the coast. From tornadoes battering Midwestern American suburbs to tennis ball-sized hailstones smashing the roofs of Italian villas, the severe weather brought about greenhouse gas emissions is shaking the foundations of the world's most important asset class. Many of our covers are about world events, but this one is close up and personal. Our leader depends for its effect on aggregating harms. By one estimate, climate change and the fight against it could wipe out 9% of the value of the world's housing by 2050, which amounts to $25 trillion, not much less than America's annual GDP. The combined exposure of state-backed insurers of last resort in wildfire-prone California and hurricane-prone Florida has exploded from $160 billion in 2017 to $633 billion today. Our cover, however, depends on breaking down the aggregate and getting readers to feel that this issue is about the particular house they call their own. We started with a plush three-story family home sinking into the ground, a fate awaiting some London houses that are built on clay, which now swells and shrinks with the seasons like a subterranean squeeze box. Or better, how about putting the house under a towering storm cloud? It is an apt metaphor for the huge bill hanging over the global financial system. This bill has three parts: paying for repairs, investing in protection, and modifying houses to limit climate change. There is sure to be an almighty fight over who should pay up. To underline the theme of global warming, we tried converting our house into a home for a lonesome polar bear. But we preferred this sketch of the house as a stranded asset. Today's property markets do not seem to reflect the cost of global warming. In Miami, the subject of much worrying about rising sea levels, house prices have increased by four-fifths this decade, much more than the American average. The evidence shows that house prices react to climate risk only after disaster has struck, when it is too late for preventive investments. Inertia is therefore likely to lead to nasty surprises. In the final cover, we washed away the peninsular backdrop to leave a seascape of wind and waves. Housing is too important an asset to be mispriced across the economy, not least because it is so vital to the financial system. The $25 trillion bill will pose problems, but doing nothing today will only make tomorrow more painful. Leaders, the sense of an ending, the rights and wrongs of assisted dying. Britain's next great social reform is coming. Here's how it should work. Britain has become a much more liberal country in recent decades. In 1981, only 12% of Britons thought that homosexuality was justifiable, according to the World Values Survey. In 2022, the figure was 66%. Over the same period, the proportion of people who were accepting of divorce rose from 18% to 64%. Where the public has led, politicians have followed. Same-sex marriages were legalized in 2013. No-fault divorces became possible in 2022. That pattern may well be about to repeat itself with assisted dying. Over two-thirds of Britons support changing the law to let someone help in the suicide of a person with a terminal illness. Assisted dying has a good chance of getting on the statute book in the near future. Bills are already in progress on the Isle of Man, in Jersey, and in Scotland. Sir Keir Starmer, the Labour leader, is sympathetic and has promised a free vote among MPs if his party wins the general election next year. If the economists had a vote, it would be unequivocally in favor. The case for assisted dying is, at its core, one of individual freedom. Britons have the right to marry whom they want. They have the right to roam. Through an obscure medieval law, some even have the right to drive sheep across London Bridge. They should have the right to choose the manner and timing of their death. The more complex question is what form an assisted dying regime should take. That is not just to ensure safeguards against abuses, though it must undoubtedly do that. It is also to make sure that the law is not drawn too tightly. Britain is in many ways late to the issue, as are countries like Ireland and France. A bill was presented to the French cabinet this week. Belgium, the Netherlands, Oregon, and Switzerland have had assisted dying laws for decades. 17 jurisdictions have passed laws since we argued in favor of legislation in 2015. Although opponents of assisted dying have deeply held beliefs and raised legitimate concerns, the actual experience of these jurisdictions straightens the argument in its favor. Take concerns about coercion. Critics argue that no regime could ever fully protect the vulnerable from relatives looking to claim an inheritance, or indeed from a state seeking to cut health care costs. Yet the evidence suggests that cases of coercion are extremely rare. The state should do its best to help people live well, whether through social support or palliative care. But if it cannot, those who truly wish to die should not be obliged to suffer. In places where an assisted death remains illegal, only those with money have the option to take matters into their own hands. On average, one Briton a week travels to Switzerland to end their life there. The rights of hypothetically vulnerable patients are taking precedence over the rights of those who are actually in anguish. Some critics say that assisted dying is a slippery slope. If this is the fundamental reason for your opposition, you are pretty much conceding the principle that there are indeed instances when it would be right to help someone die. It's the scope that is the problem. In any case, experience suggests that no such slope exists. Although eligibility criteria for an assisted death have expanded in Belgium and the Netherlands, they have never done so in jurisdictions whose initial laws were restricted to terminally ill adults. Canada's decision to postpone the extension of assisted dying laws to the mentally ill until 2027 shows that it is possible to press pause. True, the number of people seeking assisted deaths is increasing. They now make up 4% of all deaths in Canada and 5% in the Netherlands. Yet, if those higher figures are an expression of people's desire to make use of a new freedom, as it is overwhelmingly likely, they are a reason to pass laws, not to block them. Whether out of conviction or caution, politicians tend to respond to such concerns by writing laws that are based on Oregon's motto, which requires a person to be terminally ill with less than 6 months to live to be eligible for an assisted death. This is the approach being followed in Ireland. France's assisted dying bill is also limited to the terminally ill, even though a citizens' assembly convened by President Emmanuel Macron supported a broader law for those suffering unbearably from an incurable illness. The Oregon template is also likely to be one of the MPs in Westminster will eventually end up debating. If previous bills are a guide, it is too restrictive. Strict time constraints mean that people often die before they can receive the lethal medication, and many people suffer terribly with a disease that is not terminal. Canada's model, which allows someone to determine for themselves whether their suffering is unbearable, is fairer. A person there must be suffering from a serious and incurable medical condition and must wait 90 days to reflect on their decision. Arguments that this broader scope devalues disabled lives are well-meaning but paternalistic. 3/4 of Canadians with disabilities support the existing law. The thorniest issues arise when it is hard to determine whether people are of sound mind. Canada's decision to postpone the extension of assisted dying laws to people with mental health disorders is sensible for this reason. Mental suffering is as real as physical suffering, yet society's understanding of it is still inadequate. Doctors must be able to tell between a considered rational wish to die and a suicidal impulse, a distinction many clinicians feel unable to make. Dementia, which already afflicts 1 in 11 Britons over 65, is also a difficult area. It is possible for someone in the early stages of dementia to make a request in advance for an assisted death, but their wishes when the time comes should prevail. When in doubt, the best rule of thumb is not to proceed. The right balance. There is no guarantee that politicians in Britain will vote in favor of assisted dying. But when they do debate the issue, they should not default to the narrowest definition of what is a basic human right. All adults of sound mind who are enduring unbearable suffering with no prospect of recovery should be able to choose the way they die. Business unplugged. Think Tesla is in trouble? Pity even more its wannabe EV rivals. A fleet of electric car startups is struggling to stay in business. In recent months, Tesla has had a bumpy ride. In January, the electric vehicle EV pioneer warned that growth would be notably lower this year as motorist enthusiasm for battery power loses charge. The same month, it had to suspend most production at his giant factory near Berlin because of supply disruptions caused by turmoil in the Red Sea. Its market share in China, the world's biggest EV market, is falling as it fends off cheaper local competition, especially from BYD, which late last year briefly eclipsed Tesla as the world's biggest EV maker. Tesla hit another big pothole on April 2nd when it reported that it had delivered fewer than 390,000 cars in the first quarter. That was down by 8.5% from a year ago, and considerably worse than already cautious Wall Street analysts were expecting. Tesla's market value has slumped by a third this year to less than $550 billion. That is still more than any other car maker, but less than half of the $1.2 trillion it was worth in 2021. Its boss, Elon Musk, is now only the world's third richest man. If you think the billionaire and his firm are having a rough time, spare a thought for their once white-hot imitators. 3 years ago, as Mr. Musk showed the EV making could be a trillion-dollar business, investors scrambled to back the newcomers, promising to be the next Tesla. Two American startups that had gone public earlier that year were accelerating as briskly as their cars. The market capitalization of Lucid Motors, founded in 2007, exceeded $90 billion. That of Rivian, created 2 years later, hit around $150 billion. Each was worth more than Ford, which was nearly 120 years old and sold 4 million vehicles in 2021, compared with 125 for Lucid and 920 for Rivian. Chinese rivals such as Li Auto, founded in 2015, NIO, and Xiaoping, both in 2014, were also valued richly. In late 2021, the combined market value of five prominent Tesla wannabes neared a stonking $400 billion. Today, the five are worth $69 billion and falling. Fisker, an eight-year-old American firm, and Hi-Fi, a five-year-old Chinese one, have paused production. On May 25th, a crumbling share price caused the trading of Fisker's shares to be suspended, and the firm may soon be delisted. Hi-Fi may be looking to sell itself to a big established Chinese car maker. Faraday Future, which sold barely 11 of its upmarket EVs last year, is on the brink of bankruptcy. Lordstown, an American startup founded in 2018 to make electric pickups and SUVs, went bust in 2023. Even somewhat sturdier companies are struggling. VinFast, a Vietnamese firm, which was set up in 2017 and went public last year, briefly and bafflingly almost touched $190 billion in market value last August. It sold 35,000 EVs in 2023 and is now worth $9 billion. Rivian sold 50,000 and it's worth a 15th of its peak in 2021. Lucid sold 6,000 and is also worth 1/15. Li Auto, Leapmotor, NIO, and XPeng, which delivered over 800,000 cars between them last year, have also seen their share prices shrivel. Only Li turns a profit, mostly because it makes nothing but hybrid vehicles. Its market share plunged recently after it revealed its first pure EV, surviving, let alone thriving, in what was meant to be a brave new electric world, is providing tough. Which would-be Teslas, if any, will make it? It was all meant to be different, making a profit from internal combustion engines whose thousands of moving parts drove up complexity and cost, required car makers to churn out large volumes. In contrast, the new economics of battery power was supposed to bring down barriers to entry. The electric upstart, aping Tesla, by styling themselves as tech firms rather than manufacturers, reckoned they could keep costs in check by using simpler designs and reimagining production process in a way stodgy incumbents could not. Components such as batteries and electric motors can be bought off the shelf, leaving the EV makers to focus on developing whizzy software that would allow their vehicles to stand out thanks to a better experience in the car. From infotainment to mood lighting, some companies like Fisker simply outsourced the metal bending. These advantages have, however, failed to outweigh the old-school need for critical mass. Turning a profit from cars still requires producing perhaps 500,000 of them a year. Scale is vital and manufacturing is hard, sums up to Lee Sino Auto Insights, a consultancy. Though Tesla began as a luxury marquee, putting big and pricey batteries in big and pricey cars, it always eyed the mass market. Profits started coming only once it overcame the near-death experience. Production hell, in Mr. Musk's words, of trying to churn out high numbers of his cheaper Model 3. The Tesla imitators, for their part, have taken too long to start production and are now taking too long to launch new models, says Pedro Pacheco of Gartner, a consultancy. The chances of survival by serving only a high margin, high price niche are low, notes Felipe Houchois of Jefferies, an investment bank. Just look at the possibly futureless Faraday future, whose models start at $250,000. The electric insurgents are waking up to this reality. Their first step is to look down market. On March 7th, Rivian announced three less expensive models that will start arriving in 2026. Last year, XPeng signed a deal with Didi Global, a Chinese ride-hailing giant, to make cheaper cars, and forged a partnership with Volkswagen to make mass-market EVs for China. NIO plans to launch two affordable sub-brands, Alps and Firefly, even Lucid, whose cars go for as much as $250,000, plans to launch somewhat less exclusive $50,000 models within a few years. In October, Leap Motor sold a 20% stake to Stellantis, a mass-market car maker whose marquees include Citroën, Chrysler, Fiat, and Peugeot, and whose largest shareholder parts own the economist's parent company for $1.6 billion. The pair will team up to make EVs. To succeed, these efforts must still produce a competitive product with one-of-a-kind features. Tesla pulled it off by putting technology first. The result was desirable, EV that wasn't cheap, but offered a svelte look and decent range. The legacy industry's earlier attempts, such as the Nissan Leaf, were expensive, but also ugly and short of juice. Despite a strong tech focus like Tesla, most startups have failed to deliver unique products at competitive costs, as they continue to lack scale, says Patrick Hummel of UBS, a bank. Now, the novelty of clever EV technology has worn off, adds Bekram Basu of LEK, another consultancy. Good range and other once cutting-edge tech are considered table stakes, including for incumbent car makers with considerably beefier manufacturing chops. Pretty dull. As a result, many of the EV entrants lack unique big features. The cars made by Rivian and Lucid hardly stand out technologically. Their good looks alone do not justify the heavy price tag. Rivian's cheapest electric pickup cost around $70,000, half as much again as Ford's F-150, Lightning without offering one and a half as much car. In Europe, the Lucid Air, a luxury sedan, is a fair bit pricier than the comparable electric BMWs or Mercedes. Fisker's mass market EVs are well designed, but cost more than Chinese rivals with similar features, partly because its asset-light outsourcing strategy does not work well for cheaper cars. Why anyone would buy a VinFast is a mystery. Reviews of its VF8 SUV were damning, to put it charitably. With demand for EVs tippet, many of the companies need more capital to keep going. On March 25th, Lucid said it had managed to wangle another $1 billion from its biggest investor, Saudi Arabia's Sovereign Wealth Fund. Many rivals are not so lucky. Rivian had $9.4 billion in net cash at the end of 2023, but will need billions more to build its cheaper models. Gone are the days when money men would throw treasure at any firm with a plausible PowerPoint presentation and an artist's impression of a sleek electric car. Having put up billions of dollars in the years leading up to 2021, only to see billions torched, they look askance at missed deadlines, disappointing new models, and ever-receding prospects of profits. Their second thoughts have not been dispelled by the recent slowdown in growth of EV sales in many countries. Incumbent car makers have no interest in rescuing the insurgents. Mr. Hummel of UBS thinks that most of the startups will simply disappear. The likeliest to survive are the Chinese. One reason is that they appear to be the most innovative of the bunch. NIO's upmarket EVs come with the option of battery swapping and, in China at least, a vast network of stations to do it. Drivers can be on their way in minutes without getting out of the car. Bernstein, a broker, considers XPeng one of the biggest global leaders in autonomous driving technology. They are also a relative bargain compared with their Western rivals. Both NIO and XPeng, as well as Li Auto, have benefited from an impressive battery supply chain dominated by Chinese firms like CATL and steadfast support from the central and local governments, notes Mr. Li. That, in turn, has allowed the Chinese companies to keep both their cost and their prices down. The result has been rapid uptake of EVs in their giant domestic market, and with it, greater economies of scale. Another wave of car-making disruption may be swelling in China, courtesy of Chinese big tech. In 2021, Seres, an established Chinese car firm, and Huawei, the closest thing China has to a national technology champion, created Aito, a new brand dripping with fancy tech. In January, the venture delivered 33,000 cars. On March 28th, Xiaomi, which has hereto made smartphones, launched an SUV, the model manufactured by BAIC, a state-owned car giant, and costing as little as $30,000, attracted 90,000 orders in 24 hours. Xiaomi aims to take on, at least at home, both Tesla and BYD. Alibaba, China's e-commerce titan, and SAIC, another big state-owned car maker, have been producing cars together for 2 years and sold 38,000 in 2023. Foxconn, a Taiwanese contract manufacturer better known for assembling iPhones for Apple, many of them in China, aspires to build half the world's EVs for its own brand or others. If Tesla and any other survivors of the current EV shakeout thought they could catch a breath, they should think again. You're listening to Robert Mayberry on Sight into Sound Radio. You can listen to Sight into Sound on HD4 on 88.7 KUHF, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or smartphone, as well as your smart speaker. You can also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at sightintosound.org. We are Sight into Sound Radio since 1967. Finance and economics. Free exchange. What will humans do if technology solves everything? Welcome to a high-tech utopia. In Permutation City, a novel written by Greg Egan, the character Pierre, having achieved immortality within a virtual reality over which he has total control, finds himself terribly bored. So he engineers himself to have new passions. One moment he is pushing the boundaries of higher mathematics. The next he is writing operas. He'd even been interested in the Elysians, the afterlife, once. No longer, he preferred to think about table legs. Pierre's fickleness relates to a deeper point. When technology has solved humanity's deepest problems, what is left to do? That is one question considered in a new publication by Nick Bostrom, a philosopher at the University of Oxford, whose last book argued that humanity faced a 1 in 6 chance of being wiped out in the next 100 years. Perhaps owing to the development of dangerous forms of artificial intelligence, AI. Mr. Bostrom's latest book, Deep Utopia, he considers a rather different outcome. What happens if AI goes extraordinarily well? Under one scenario, Mr. Bostrom contemplates the technology progresses to the point at which he can do all economically valuable work at near zero cost. Under yet more radical scenario, even tasks that you might think would be reserved for humans, such as parenting, can be done better by AI. This may sound more dystopian than utopian, but Mr. Bostrom argues otherwise. Start with the first scenario, which Mr. Bostrom labels a post-scarcity utopia. In such a world, the need for work would be reduced. Almost a century ago, John Maynard Keynes wrote an essay entitled Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren, which he predicted that 100 years into the future, his wealthy descendants would need to work for only 15 hours a week. That has not quite come to pass, but working time has fallen greatly. In the rich world, average weekly working hours have dropped from more than 60 in the late 19th century to fewer than 40 today. The typical American spends a third of their waking hours on leisure activities and sports. In the future, they may wish to spend their time on things beyond humanity's current conception. As Mr. Bostrom writes, when aided by powerful tech, the space of possible for us experiences extends far beyond those that are accessible to us with our present unoptimized brains. Yet Mr. Bostrom label of the post-scarcity utopia might be slightly misleading. The economic explosion caused by superintelligence would still be limited by physical resources, most notably land. Although space exploration may hugely increase the building space available, it will not make it infinite. There are also intermediate worlds where humans develop powerful new forms of intelligence, but do not become space-faring. In such worlds, wealth may be fantastic, but lots of it could be absorbed by housing, much as the case in rich countries today. Positional goods, which boost the status of their owners, are also still likely to exist and are, by their nature, scarce. Even if AIs surpass humans in art, intellect, music, and sports, humans will probably continue to derive value from surpassing their fellow humans, for example, by having tickets to the hottest events. In 1977, Fred Hirsch, an economist, argued in The Social Limits to Growth that as wealth increases, a greater fraction of human desire consists of positional goods. Time spent competing goes up. The price of such goods increases, and so their share of GDP rises. This pattern may continue in an AI utopia. Mr. Bostrom notes some types of competition are a failure of coordination. If everyone agrees to stop competing, they would have time for other better things, which could further boost growth. Yet some types of competition, such as sports, have intrinsic value and are worth preserving. Humans may also have nothing better to do. Interest in chess has grown since IBM's Deep Blue first defeated Garry Kasparov, then world champion in 1977. An entire industry has emerged around esports, where computers can comfortably defeat humans. Their revenues are expected to grow at a 20% annual rate over the next decade, reaching nearly $11 billion by 2032. Several groups in society today give us a sense of how future humans might spend their time. Aristocrats and bohemians enjoy the arts. Monastics live within themselves. Athletes spend their lives in sports. The retired dabble in all these pursuits. Everyone's early retirement. Won't tasks such as parenting remain the refuge of humans? Mr. Bostrom is not so sure. He argues that beyond the post-scarcity world lies a post-instrumental one in which AIs will become superhuman at child care, too. Keynes himself wrote that there is no country and no people, I think, who can look forward to the age of leisure and of abundance without a dread. For we have been trained too long to survive and not to enjoy. To judge from the behavior and the achievements of the wealthy classes today, in any quarter of the world, the outlook is very depressing. The Bible puts it more succinctly. Idle hands are the devil's workshop. These dynamics suggest a paradox of progress. Although most humans want a better world, if tech becomes too advanced, they may lose purpose. Mr. Bostrom argues that most people would still enjoy activities that have intrinsic value, such as eating tasty food. Utopians believing life had become too easy might decide to challenge themselves, perhaps by colonizing a new planet to try to re-engineer civilization from scratch. At some point, however, even such adventures might cease to feel worthwhile. It is an open question how long humans would be happy hopping between passions, as Pierre does in Permutation City. Economists have long believed that humans have unlimited wants and desires, suggesting there are endless variations on things people would like to consume. With the arrival of an AI utopia, this would be put to the test. Quite a lot would ride on the result. Briefing: Risk of Subsidence. Homeowners face a $25 trillion bill from climate change. Property, the world's biggest asset class, is also the most vulnerable. The residents of northern Italy had never seen anything like the thunderstorm that mauled their region last summer. Hailstones as big as 19 centimeters across pummeled Milan, Parma, Turin, and Venice. Windows were broken, solar panels smashed, tiles cracked, and cars dented. The episode cost the insurance industry $4.8 billion, making it the most expensive natural disaster in the world from July to September. The figures exclude America, which collates such data separately. Yet insurance executives, although smarting, were not surprised. Climate change is making such incidents much more common. In the decade from 2000 to 2009, only three thunderstorms cost the industry more than $1 billion at current prices. From 2010 to 2019, there were 10. Since 2020, there have already been 6. Such storms now account for more than a quarter of the cost to the insurance industry from natural disasters, according to Swiss Re, a reinsurance firm. In Europe, not known for extreme weather, losses have topped $5 billion a year for the past 3 years. Climate change is doing vast damage to property all around the world, and not always in the places or the ways that people imagine. Hurricanes, wildfires, and floods are becoming more common and more severe. But so are more mundane banes. In London, for instance, the drying of the clay on which most of the city stands during summer heat waves is causing unexpected subsidence, landing homeowners with big bills. A similar problem afflicts Amsterdam, where many older buildings are built on wooden piles inserted into the boggy soil in lieu of conventional foundations. Extended dry spells in summer are lowering the water table, drying out the piles and exposing them to the air. This allows the piles to rot, prompting the buildings above to sag. Unlucky homeowners can be saddled with bills of $100,000 or more for the remedial work. And on top of the expense of repairs, climate change is foisting on homeowners
comes the likelihood that government will oblige them to install low-carbon heating and cooling or improve their home's energy efficiency, adding yet more to their cost. Money pit. The upshot is an enormous bill for property owners. Estimates are necessarily vague given the uncertainties not just of the climate but also of government policy. But MSCI, which compiles financial indices, thinks that over the next 25 years, the cost of climate change in terms both of damage to property and of investments to reduce emissions may amount to almost a tenth of the value of the housing and institutional investors' portfolios. If the same holds true in general, the world is facing roughly a $25 trillion hit. The impending bill is so huge, in fact, that it will have grim implications not just for personal prosperity, but also for the financial system. Property is the world's most important asset class, accounting for an estimated 2/3 of global wealth. Homes are the heart of many of the world's most important financial markets. With mortgages serving as collateral in money markets and shoring up the balance sheets of banks. If the size of the risk suddenly sinks in and borrowers and lenders alike realize the collateral underpinning so many transactions is not worth as much as they thought, a wave of repricing will reverberate through financial markets. Government finances, too, will be affected as homeowners clamor for expensive bailouts. Climate change, in short, could prompt the next global property crash. At the present, the risks of climate change are not properly reflected in house prices. A study in Nature, a journal, finds that if the expected losses from increased flooding alone were taken into account, the value of American homes will fall by $121 billion to $237 billion. Many buyers and sellers are simply unaware of the risk. When these are brought home, price changes, a study published in 2018 in the Journal of Urban Economics, found a persistent 8% drop in the prices of homes built on floodplains in New York following Hurricane Sandy, which caused widespread flooding in 2012. Properties just inside zones in California where sellers are required to disclose the risk of wildfires cost about 4% less than houses just outside such zones. In many cases, the risk climate change poses to property are only slowly becoming apparent, as with London's geology. The distinctive yellowish bricks with which many homes in the city are built are made from the clay on which the houses stand. It is good to build with, but recently has proved not so good to build on. During the now milder winters, there is higher rainfall, since warmer air can hold more moisture. As the clay absorbs the rain, it expands. Warmer summers then dry it out again, causing the ground to contract. That would not be a problem if the expansion and contraction were uniform, says Owen Brooker, a structural engineer. But they are not, owing to trees which suck up moisture in the vicinity. The resulting variation in the accordion effect causes the ground to buckle and twist in places, and the houses above to list and to crack. 2/5 of London's housing stock 1.8 million homes, will be susceptible to sustenance by 2030, according to the British Geological Survey. Other nearby cities, such as Oxford and Cambridge, are also at risk. Remediation, often by installing concrete underpinning, typically costs around £10,000, $12,500, but can be much more. PwC, a consultancy, estimates that British home insurers will be paying out $1.5 billion a year on sustenance claims by 2030. To be honest, the insurance companies would do themselves a good service by making people aware, says Mr. Brooker. Analysts call the direct impacts of climate change, such as this shrink swell effect, physical risk. Some, like shrink swell, are chronic. Others are acute, such as hurricanes, floods, and wildfires. In either case, not only can a house be completely destroyed, but the ongoing risk of further such calamities can make it hazardous to rebuild in the same place. Even the simplest of changes in the weather can make houses uninhabitable. Only a small minority of Indian homes have air conditioning. So if the temperature rises much, many can become unbearably hot. Physical risks are growing everywhere. The problem is not limited to dry, thundery summers in Europe, according to the National Centers for Environmental Information, a government agency. America suffered 28 natural disasters that did more than $1 billion of damage last year, exceeding the previous record of 22 in 2020. Meanwhile, Typhoon Doksuri, which hit the Philippines and then southern China last year, was the most costly typhoon in history. The risks are not spread evenly, however. Research conducted by the Bank of England in 2022 found that just 10% of postal code districts, each roughly the size of a small town, would account for 45% of the mortgages that would be impaired if average global temperatures reached 3.3 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, largely because of the increased risk of flooding in those places. For similar reasons, a back-of-the-envelope calculation suggests that roughly 40% of the value of property in Amsterdam could be wiped out by physical risk compared with just 7% for Tokyo. Data are scarcest for the impact on poorer countries. But many of the world's most populated cities are coastal. A study published in 2017 by Christian Aid, a charity, suggests that, in terms of population, Kolkata and Mumbai in India and Dhaka in Bangladesh are the most exposed to rising sea levels. In terms of the value of the property at risk, the most vulnerable are Miami, Guangzhou, and New York. Tokyo rose. But the risks are not fixed. They can be reduced, most obviously through private and public efforts to improve preparedness. Part of the reason that the risks to Tokyo are low is that it dramatically improved drainage and flood defenses after Typhoon Kit hit in 1966, flooding 42,000 buildings. When Typhoon Lan brought similar amounts of rain in 2017, only 35 buildings were swamped. In theory, house and insurance prices should provide a clear market signal about the risk of climate-related harm to any given property. But even in places obviously in harm's way, such as Miami, the signal is often distorted. For one thing, it was only in March that Florida's legislature approved a bill requiring those selling a property to disclose if it had previously flooded. Worse, there is good reason to think that home insurance in Florida is underpriced. Most Floridians would gasp at such a notion, according to Insurify, an insurance company. The average annual premium for a typical single-family home in the state is likely to hit $11,759 this year. Yet even with such swinging rates, several private home insurers have gone bust or withdrawn from Florida in recent years. The state government, however, shields homeowners from the market through a state-owned insurer last resort, which provides policies to homes that private insurers will not cover. Citizens Property Insurance Corporation has become Florida's largest home insurer. Its exposure is now $423 billion, much more than the state's public debt. And on all houses that, by definition, other insurers deem too risky to cover. This suggests that Citizens has been providing a big subsidy to homeowners from taxpayers. Flood insurance underwritten by the federal government suffers from similar flaws. First Street Foundation, which aims to track the threats to American property from climate change, calculates that home values in West Palm Beach, a glitzy city up the coast from Miami, would fall by 40% if owners had to pay the true cost of insuring against hurricanes and floods. That would wipe out many homeowners' equity and leave lots of mortgages without adequate collateral. Mortgaging the future. In democracies where lots of voters own their homes, politicians have an incentive to shield homeowners from the bill from climate change for as long as possible. Even in Germany, which still has a large rented sector, the rollover gas boilers is considered a cautionary tale. Procrastination is also a reflection of the global logic of climate change. Even if a government introduces stringent measures to cut emissions in its own country, that does not necessarily reduce global emissions and therefore physical risk. No amount of investment in energy efficiency in German homes, for instance, would have prevented the floods in 2021 that caused more than $40 billion in damage. Yet the longer governments protect homeowners from the risk, the larger they become. Vulnerable places like Miami grow even as climate change intensifies, with new arrivals assuming that taxpayers will defray the ballooning future cost. At some point, that assumption will become untenable, with unpredictable consequences. Climate change is often cast as something happening to other people in faraway places and in desperate circumstances. But for much of the rich world, the costs are starting to come home. We have come to the end of our program. I have been reading The Economist. I'm Robert Mayberry, and this has been a production of Sight and the Sound Radio, Houston, Texas.